Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for coming. It's good to have you here again. We are going to try to do what we've been talking about for maybe 4 weeks now. I want to read through all these so we get a parallel. I don't want to spend a night studying each of these, but I'm trying to create like a parallel, an overview. We've got some questions, things like, you know, is the Antichrist Jewish or can he be a Gentile? We got questions about like what parts have been fulfilled. There's different views on eschatology. What is completed? What is yet to be fulfilled? One we've left hanging out there, is Babylon going to be rebuilt? Is Babylon a moving target, the center of the world? We've always got the question of the rapture. When's the rapture going to take place? Pre-trib, mid-trib? There's many questions that we come up with. And so as we go through this, we'll take a look at some of these and not necessarily get answers, but have some things on the table. So I'm going to start in Daniel chapter 9, and I'm going to go through these verses, Daniel 9 and then Daniel 7, and just kind of get an overview, and also Daniel 11 right in here, and then we'll read through these. Here we go, Daniel chapter 9. We got into this last week, and first of all, Daniel chapter 9, if you go to chapter 9, verse 1, and this is just interesting to kind of put this in perspective. It says, in the first year of Darius, a son of Xerxes, a Mede by descent, who was made ruler over the Babylonian kingdom. And of course, that's important because actually Cyrus was the emperor, but he put Darius in charge of Babylon. In the first year of his reign, I, Daniel, understood from Scripture, and he understood it from the book of Jeremiah, that the 70 years was up and Israel's going to be going back. Then you've got his prayer. What's interesting there is the first year of his reign of Darius, that was around 539 B.C. So this prophecy is being given in 539 B.C. Again, that's nice to know the dating of these. And then we're going to jump way ahead into verse 24. We'll read 24. 77s are decreed for your people and your holy city. And that's, again, that's our time chart, timetable. 77s. Sevens means weeks or periods of seven. It could be 7 days, 7 weeks, 7 months, seven something. The only thing that really fits is, I think it's to be understood as years, are decreed for your people, and that's talking for Israel. There's 490 years for Israel, and these things will happen. There's a list of things to finish transgression, to put an end to sin, and that all is going to take place because of the Messiah, to atone for wickedness, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. So that goes. That is, in a sense, the coming of the Messiah that we've been reading about in Isaiah on Tuesday or Monday nights. The Messiah is going to come. He's going to suffer. He's going to take care of atonement, take care of sin, and then he's going to have set up righteousness. Is going to come. He's going to seal up prophecy. All the prophecies are going to be fulfilled, and then we're going to have the eternal state. There it is, and anoint the most holy. Now again, that's either the holy place or the holy Christ, but that's all going to take place in those 490 years. Then he says, the angel says this, know and understand this, from the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until the anointed one, the ruler, comes, there will be seven sevens and 62 sevens. So that's a total of 69 sevens or 483 years. Now when it says, from the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem, I've got these verses written down, and you can go there if you'd like to. We got three verses. Go back to Nehemiah chapter 2, verse 1, because there's going to be an issuing of a decree by Cyrus to go back and restore Jerusalem, and then there's going to be another one where the walls are going to be decreed. So Nehemiah chapter 1, we're just Nehemiah chapter 2, verse 1. It gives the year. It says chapter 2 of Nehemiah, in the month of Nisan, that would be right around April, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was brought to him. Now, again, when it's interesting when it says when wine was brought to him, there are his wine bowls with his name on it. The whole set are in display in the British Museum. I've got a picture. They're about this big as far as being round, and they're silver, and they're bowls, flat bowls. They look almost like a plate. They're bowls for drinking wine. The oxidation would be better in an open container. And it says right on there, Artaxerxes, and it's inscribed all the way around in cuneiform, and they found the whole set of them. So when it talks about when wine was brought to him, it's very possible, it's not unlikely, that Nehemiah handled those very silver bowls or plates that are in the British Museum. And I've got a picture of them. And I've got one blown up on my wall at home. Anyway, when wine was brought to him, he said, I took wine in and gave it to the king. And as you go through, he's upset. Nehemiah is upset that Jerusalem is still in ruins, and he's going to have permission to go back and begin to restore Jerusalem. Go to Nehemiah chapter 6, verse 15. Nehemiah chapter 6, verse 15. This is October 2nd, 445. That would have been April of 445. This is now October. Chapter 6, verse 15. So the wall was completed on the 25th of Elul in 52 days. That's October 2nd, 445. So that would be this right here. The issuing of the decree to restore or rebuild the walls is right there in Nehemiah. If you go to Ezra, just turn a couple pages, and you're going to see Ezra, or go back a couple pages. Ezra chapter 7. And this would be Cyrus, with the Cyrus cylinder records this. Chapter 7, verse 11. They have a problem. They don't know if they've got permission to build, and it's years after Cyrus, but people live north of the Jews, the Good Samaritans. The Samaritans are causing trouble for the Jews. They're trying to rebuild, and they go back, and the Jews say, "We've got permission to do this." So they go back and they check the archives, maybe going back to Daniel's archives. Which would have been official documents. And they find this copy, chapter 7, verse 11. This is a copy of the letter King Artaxerxes had given to Ezra, the priest and the teacher, a man learned in matters concerning the commandments and decrees of the Lord for Israel. Artaxerxes, king of kings, to Ezra the priest. And now look at verse 13. Now I decree that any Israelites in my kingdom, including priests and Levites, who wish to go back to Jerusalem may go back. And there's a date of that would be 458. So some of those dates, again, how we're going to number this, they've got different opinions. But Daniel's speaking this in 539, or the angel, it says there's a day coming when a decree is going to be made. And when that decree comes down, you've got 62 sevens and seven sevens until the anointed one comes. So you're either going to count from here or count from here. And ultimately, you're going to end up at a date close to 30 A.D., the time of Jesus' baptism, possibly. You could try to end up on Jesus' crucifixion. And that would be right in there. That is the ending of that 483 years, leaving seven more years, which causes complete confusion because you'd think of 490 years as being sequential. So that in Jesus, if he's going to be, if it's going to be the anointed one, the ruler is going to come in the 483rd year, like at his baptism, then you've got 7 years after that. It's all going to be completed in the next 7 years. But then it's not, because then things go back and the temple's not destroyed for another 40 years. And then we've got the church age, and clearly we've been here, you know, another 2,000 years. But that doesn't nullify the prophecy. It just gives us some questions of when is it going to be fulfilled. Some will say it has been. We go back to Daniel chapter 9. Again, we're rushing through this, just giving us some foundation here. Maybe you can ask some questions as we get through this. Okay, I'm going back to verse 25 of Daniel 9. Know and understand this, from the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem. Now, again, those are some options. And again, there's always more options. Until the anointed one, that's Messiah, that's the Christ, that's the seed of the woman, that's the son of David from the tribe of Judah, till the ruler comes, there will be seven sevens and 62 sevens, or 483 years. So from this decree until he comes, you've got 483 years. So there's a good indication. That's why you've got things happening like possibly, although there's probably other signs involved in this. That's why the wise men knew. That's why Simeon on the Temple Mount knew. That's why Anna knew. That's why everything's kind of coming into place. They're looking for this. This is why Herod's uptight because, you know, another king has been born. It's the time. Until the ruler, the anointed one, comes, there'll be seven sevens and 62 sevens. It will be rebuilt with streets, meaning the city's going to be rebuilt, and a trench, that means a moat, but in times of trouble. I mean, they're going to build the defense system, they're going to have streets, but it's going to be built in times of trouble. And that's what you've got through these years right here. You've got the Persians, then you've got the Greeks, then you've got the Seleucids, you've got the Maccabean revolt, then the coming of the Romans. So it's going to be rebuilt, but it's going to be a troubled time. 62 sevens. They'll be rebuilt streets in a trench, but in times of trouble. After 62 sevens, now that would refer to the 483 years, the anointed one, the one who comes in the 483rd year, the anointed one will be cut off and have nothing. So here comes your anointed one, which means the Messiah. It's the Hebrew word, it's Messiah. The word for in the Greek is Christos, we call it Christ. He's going to come. And this is the king, this is the ruler, this is the one we're waiting for. He comes and what happens? He gets cut off, meaning he dies. Nothing happens. It says, after 62 sevens, the anointed one will be cut off and will have nothing in the NIV. The people of the ruler who will, now this is interesting, the people of the ruler who will come will destroy the city and the sanctuary. Now notice right here, the people, which is the Romans, after he's cut off and has nothing, the Romans will destroy the city and the sanctuary. Now that's clearly 70 AD. Well, again, I say clearly, I'm clearly interpreting that way. Obviously, everything I interpret could be wrong, could be missing, you know what I'm saying? And you got to be careful because you make one misstep here and it'll send you down the wrong road. But it all makes sense to me in the way I'm seeing it. Will destroy the city and the sanctuary. Jerusalem is burnt, but also the temple. And Titus, who was there and took the city of Jerusalem, according to Josephus, he gave orders that the temple is not to be burnt. The temple is to be spared because it was so glorious. It was one of Herod's grandest buildings. But it's interesting, the soldiers got out of control, some curtains caught on fire, and the whole thing, it's lined in wood, the whole thing goes up in flames. And it's like, great. So according to Josephus, Titus didn't want to burn it. But nonetheless, it says here, it will be burnt. So you got Titus's word versus the word of the Lord, and there it is burnt. But nonetheless, it's destroyed in 70 AD. The end will come like a flood. War will continue until the end, and desolations have been decreed. Again, if you're a preterist, that was all fulfilled there, and it's over. All the prophecy that we're looking at tonight was fulfilled in 70 AD. Now, I'm not a preterist, I'm futurist. Meaning some of these things, right here, was this fulfilled? The people of the ruler who will come. Now, again, it says the people of the ruler who will come. Now, the ruler who will come is that Vespasian who began the war, or Titus, the one who finished the war after his father became emperor, after Nero committed suicide, or is the ruler who will come the Antichrist? Because here's the anointed one, but then when the anointed one is cut off, now what you're looking for is the ruler who's going to come. And now it says the people of the ruler who will come will destroy the city. Now you can build on that because the legion that came in and was led into Jerusalem came out of Syria, came from just north. The Roman legion, it didn't march all the way from Rome. It came out of Syria or to the north. And so the people who destroyed it, the Romans, came out of Syria, and they're the people of the ruler who will come. And so now you can push that. You can build on that. It's up, north and northern area of Israel. Again, that's not a slam dunk, but you're dancing around right there with some information that needs to be unraveled. Then it says, verse 27, he will confirm a covenant with many for 1 7. Who is he? The preterists, for example, and others will say, well, he's the anointed one, the Christ. Jesus is going to make a covenant, and the covenant he makes is the new covenant, the covenant spoken of Jeremiah, and now they're talking about the new covenant, and they take the seven and spiritualize it and go a different direction. Or he is the ruler that was mentioned of the people who destroyed the temple. The ruler is going to come from those people, and when he does come, he will confirm a covenant with many, the many being Israel, for 1 7. Now here comes the question. Again, I don't know the answer. Is the Antichrist Jewish? And there's proof that you could go that way. Is the Antichrist going to come from the Gentile nations and make a treaty? He's going to make a treaty, it seems like he's coming from a Gentile nation. But you go back to Bible verses, he's got to be from the tribe of David. The Jews, like I said last week, are looking for someone that's going to bring peace, someone that's going to recognize them as a nation, and someone is going to give them the temple and allow them to restore temple worship. The man who does that will be the one they recognize as the one who fulfills the role of the Messiah. They're not looking for a kingdom in the future. They're not looking for heaven. They're looking for a kingdom on the earth. And that's exactly what they're doing. And their model is, like I said last night, Cyrus. Because Cyrus did the very thing. He's the one that sends them back, recognizes them as a nation, gives them the temple, and lets them restore temple worship. And there, he is called in the book of Isaiah, the anointed one. God says, calls him, my anointed one. Cyrus was anointed to do the work of setting the people back, but was he the anointed one, the Christ? Well, no, but he did do that work. So you see, you got some confusion there, because the anointed one is used for Cyrus, who sent them back, but it's also the anointed one is the coming Christ, the Messiah. So when it talks about the anointed one, or he who will come here, you can see how they can get an image of an actual Gentile leader. I mean, look what Trump's doing today. Is Trump the Antichrist? Again, I don't think so, but I mean, he's making deals, he's making peace treaties. Somehow he negotiates, gives them the Temple Mount back, and they sign a 7-year treaty with, you know, some Muslim nations to the north, especially like Syria, Lebanon. It's like, oh my gosh, what are we seeing here? Again, that's not a political statement. I'm just saying it's going to be a player like that. Potentially. Anyway, he will confirm a covenant with many for 1-7, and that 1-7 would be 7 years. There's a 7-year treaty. In the middle of the seven years, which would be 3.5 years, he will put an end to the sacrifice. In other words, they're going to rebuild the temple. They're going to begin the sacrificial system after 3.5 years. He said you can have it for 7 years. He's going to stop it at the 3.5-year mark. He will put an end to the sacrifice and offerings, the Jewish offerings, and on a wing of the temple, he will set up an abomination that causes desolation until the end that is decreed is poured out on him. So there's the end of this. It's all set up for, there's a time that God's going to begin this process. And like we were talking at the beginning of class before everyone got here, it's like where we're at today, all these things, it's like this looks like we could be just stepping right into these events. But if you go back and you get the image that the 483 years, and after 483 years, there's one more seven. That seven has been hanging there ever since the resurrection or the baptism of Christ or his ascension. And Satan is not in some negotiations with the Lord saying, you know, there's a date that he can't do anything. He's just waiting. If it's typical spiritual warfare, he's been trying, probably from the Garden of Eden, but he's been trying since the resurrection, since the coming of Christ, to get that Antichrist into position and set these things into effect. And that you can say he tried it in 70 AD. He tried it in, you know, during the persecutions, the early persecutions. He may have tried it. We mentioned Julian the Apostate, who was one of the nephews of Constantine, who took the throne, became the Roman emperor, and he told them to rebuild the temple. And they actually began rebuilding the temple around, I don't know, it's be around 385 or something. I just pulled that out of the air tonight when we were talking. But that got put to an end because certain things happened there. Julian got killed in a war against the Parthians, and that all ended. Then you've got the Crusades, or you get the rise of Islam, and then you've got the fall of Constantinople. You've got World War I. You've got World War II. I mean, it's like, so this, the Antichrist or Satan's attempt, he's not waiting for this certain day. God has got a certain day set. He's waiting. But Satan probably every day is trying to fire up the anti. He's trying to kick the, that's why, oh, could this be it? Well, Satan's been trying for 2,000, potentially. I mean, I can't show you the verse. But he's been trying to get this thing to happen, but something's holding it back until the appointed time. So that's what's happening right here. Now, what's interesting about this, he'll set a wing of the temple, he'll set up an abomination that causes desolation. And what causes people to stumble in this area is during the days of the Maccabees, if we go like 165, say, B.C., Alexander, his kingdom had been split into four parts, and one of his generals, Seleucia, took up the northern part, which was Syria, called the Seleucid Kingdom. They fought against the Egyptian Greek emperor, Ptolemy, and his family lines. These are the kings that are detailed in Daniel. In fact, Daniel chapter 10 in 11 is going to give you detail of that in prophecy. But anyway, Antiochus Epiphanes is one of them. He comes down and he goes into the temple. He tells the Jews, you can't follow your law, stop circumcising your children, burn the scriptures, and become Greeks. And they had to celebrate Greek holidays and built gymnasiums, had Super Bowls and all this kind of thing. And he goes into the temple and burns and offers a pig on the altar, an abomination that causes desolation. And they actually had to shut the temple down until Judas Maccabeus retook the Temple Mount and all that. So that abomination that causes desolation, it did happen in 165, something just like that. The treaty was broken. And so if you're a preterist, you look at this verse and say, it's already been fulfilled. The problem is in Matthew, and we'll see this if I hustle, in Matthew, Jesus goes to these verses and identifies it in 30 AD and says it's going to happen in the future, which wipes out the preterist argument that this was the fulfillment. It's still going to happen. You see how these things keep waving through. It's like they keep coming, not fulfilling, trying, knocking on the door, but never being able to step out on this full scene. So that's Daniel chapter 9. Let's go back to Daniel chapter 7. Daniel 7, verse 20. And look at a few verses here. Oh, okay, let's just read this. I don't want to go into a lot of detail because all these have images. But here's some. This is a nice description of the Antichrist. And do realize that Daniel does have a place, especially in chapter 11, we're going to go there next, where it looks like he's talking about Antiochus Epiphanes and the Maccabean Revolt. Everything is happening just like it says. Then all of a sudden, it switches, and it's like the Antiochus Epiphanes does things that he never did because he dies right here. But then the prophecy continues, meaning there are some things he never got done. He died too early. So what happens, a good way of understanding that was Antiochus Epiphanes pushing it, and then he was eliminated. And then when the Antichrist comes, he's going to repeat a lot of these things and then take it to the fulfillment. But nonetheless, here is the Antichrist and some things about this. Chapter 7, verse 19, Daniel says he just had a vision. And again, we could go through all this. Then I wanted to know the true meaning of the fourth beast. Remember the four beasts. You've got the lion, the bear, the leopard, and then the fourth one, which was like iron. It was unlike the other beasts. The others were actual animals in the vision. This was iron, almost like a machine. So, whoa, what is this? And typically, that's understood to be Rome, and it's something scary about Rome that, like, bothered Dan, because the other ones are sequential, and they come, and then someone replaces them, they replace. But this beast that was iron, like Rome, it's like, could it be that it seems to have passed away, but it resurfaces and regains its territory? Or part of that could be part of it. But nonetheless, he's going to talk about the fourth beast, whoever the fourth beast is. I say it's Rome, but leave it open. I mean, don't answer all these questions with an exclamation point. I like to put suggestions in my own study, have suggestions, and when everything lines up, it's going to read just like a novel. It's going to be just perfect. But if you got these stumbling stones, you put an exclamation point and say, I've got to make this fit, you're going to end up messing up your study because you're trying to, you're taking a dirt road and you're going to slow down the process. Does that make sense, what I just said? So you want these things just to flow. So it's just, that's why you got to keep studying it. Plus, it's a mystery. It's in a mystery formula. And again, Daniel himself doesn't understand it. He asked the angel, can you explain this to me? And the angel says, go your way, Daniel. It's sealed up until the time of the end. So for anyone to stand here and say, yes, Daniel couldn't, the angel says, you can't understand it, but fortunately, Galen's with you this evening, and I can explain it to you. Well, that's right there. That means you don't really understand what you're talking about. Chapter 7, verse 19. Then I wanted to know the true meaning of the fourth beast, which was different from the others, and most terrifying, with its iron teeth and bronze claws. Notice iron and bronze. The beast that crushed and devoured its victims and trampled underfoot whatever's left. I'll tell you what I try to do with this. When I try to figure into this, I try and figure Islam into this. Meaning this is Rome, but it's going to come back and it's going to come back as Islam. And a lot of these things, again, I'm not saying that's true. I'm just saying I want that to fit in my eschatology that Islam is going to be the kingdom of the beast and it's going to crush and devour its victims. And again, so that's what's happening in my mind. I'm trying to see if Islam will fit. Now, if it doesn't fit, I want to be blatant. That's stupid. It doesn't even fit. But that's what's happening. I know it's Rome. I think I know it's Rome. And then something's going to happen. It's going to appear in the future again. But is it Islam? Is it Islam in the territory, the eastern city or eastern territories of the Roman Empire? Like Syria and Lebanon was Roman territory, but now it's Muslim territory and it's going to continue again and rebuild these things. Again, I'm not telling you have to accept that. That's what I'm trying to do. Verse 20, I also want to know about the 10 horns on its head and the other horn that came up before which the three of them fell. And we could study all that. This all repeats in the book of Revelation at some level, it looks like. The horn that looked more imposing than the others, and that would be the Antichrist, we understand, and that had eyes and a mouth that spoke boastfully. So he says, what was that? That the horn represents a kingdom or a king. As I watched, this horn was waging war against the saints and defeating them. So if you want to be eschatological, you want to be an end time student, then you've got a little horn that's boastful and proud. And when he comes against the saints, he comes against the saints and defeats them. You are looking at being defeated in this age as a saint. Well, we're going to overcome. Well, you're stupid because that's not what it says. You understand? I'm sorry, stupid. But it means like, nothing can stop us. There's no weapon formed against us. Well, no, it says right here, this weapon is going to overcome you. So there is persecution. If this is yet future, there is persecution in store for the church. If we meet the Antichrist, he is going to come against us and we will get crushed. Well, that would never happen to Jesus. Isaiah said, he will be crushed, marred beyond human likeness. Well, as I watched, this horn is waging war against the saints and defeating them until the Ancient of Days came and pronounced judgment in favor of the saints of the Most High. Yes, your victory is coming, but your victory is not of this age. It's when the Ancient of Days comes back, sets up his kingdom, and says, now we're going to balance the score sheet. And the time came when they possessed the kingdom. Of course, that's the kingdom. The angel gave me this explanation. This fourth beast is a fourth kingdom. I think it's Rome. And many people do. That will appear on the earth. It will be different from all the other kingdoms. It will be different from Babylon, Persia, and Greece. Now, how is it different? And will devour the other kingdoms, and will devour the whole earth. Now, again, Rome conquered the Mediterranean world, and they considered themselves the world rulers, but they didn't touch China, and they didn't go down deep into Africa. There's a lot of Europe, up to England. The whole earth, trampling it down and crushing it. So was that Rome like a test run? And then there's going to be another kingdom that's going to take it even further extending. But even the Antichrist is going to try to rule the world, but he's going to have trouble, like we said before, with the king of the east coming against him, could be China, the king of the north, which could be coming out of Russia or Europe somewhere. There's going to be a king of the south in that game. So, I mean, even the Antichrist is not going to be like this world leader. He's going to try to be, but there's going to be opposition against him. The ten horns are the ten kings who will come from this kingdom. After them, another king will arise, different from the earlier ones. He will subdue three kings. He will speak against the Most High. Now, this is the Antichrist. He will speak against the Most High and oppress his saints and try to change the set times and the laws. So whatever that means, he's going to try to change the times, the set times. Is that the Jewish holidays? Or is that some kind of a calendar system? Is that some kind of the annual solar system? I mean, what does that mean? He's going to change the times. Is it going to be the iPhone? I don't know. And the laws. Now, does that mean the Jewish laws? Or that means, postmodernism, all reality? We're going to change the laws of gravity and science are all going to change? I mean, what does he mean? He's going to change the laws or try to change the laws. The saints will be handed over. Now, this is the third time you get to hear this. The saints will be handed over to him for a time, times, and half a time. Now, that's understood as time is a year, times is plural, 2 years, one plus two, and half a time. So 1 year, 2 years is 3.5 years, which is half the tribulation or half the 70th week. So the saints, and this for me, now the saints right here, for me, this is where you're going to have some belief. Now he's saying saints, he's not saying specifically to Daniel, your people. He's saying the saints, your people is the nation of Israel. And sometimes your people don't know what's going on. Sometimes your people will kill the Messiah. Sometimes your people are not the saints, but your people are the people that have the covenant with Abraham that God is going to be faithful to and restore you and make you part of the kingdom. Meanwhile, the saints, these would be the holy ones. Now, the holy ones, that can mean angels, but I don't think he's talking about the angels being oppressed by the Antichrist. These are the true believers. Now, they could be Jews or we could be just, in a general sense, those who are believing. So you've got this 7-year period right here from the issuing of the decree, or he's making a treaty. He's going to break it at the halfway point. I would assume during this first 3.5 years, he's going to bring trouble on the saints. And that's why you get in Revelation, you've got that sixth seal, is you've got all these martyrs under the throne that have died for the word of the Lord and for the name of Jesus. And so that would be here. That would mean right here, there's an end to it right here, which is a nice place to stick the rapture right there. But nonetheless, they're going to be handed over for that. There it is. They're going to be handed over for time and a half a time. But the court will sit, and his power will be taken away and completely destroyed forever. That sounds like the end of the seven. So does this persecution take place in the second half of the tribulation? Possibly. That would push for, like, you know, the Christians or the believers would be there in the second half. The court will be set, and his power will be taken away and completely destroyed forever. Completely destroyed forever. The seed of the woman is going to crush the serpent's head, completely taken away forever. Then the sovereignty, power, and greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven will be handed over to the saints. So yes, you do win in the end. There is victory in the end, but you're going to have to go through this. And the kingdom is going to be handed over to the saints, the people of the Most High. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and all rulers will worship and obey him. This is the end of the matter. I, Daniel, was deeply troubled by my thoughts, and my face turned pale, but I kept the matter to myself. So there is an encounter with true eschatology. It's deeply troubling. It makes you pale. It's so scary, you know, overwhelming. And then you keep the matter to yourself. In other words, you don't write a book and go on and say, I had a dream, I had a vision, I went to heaven, I saw this. It's like you keep it to yourself. In other words, everybody that's out spouting stuff, they're not following Daniel's procedure there. Okay, I'll stop right there, and we're going to keep going to chapter 11. Questions or comments right there? Again, that's a lot of material, but does something jump out at you that's interesting? And here's that wait time. Okay, chapter 11. We surge forward. Chapter 11, verse 36. Now, in chapter 11, this is a great verse, and I've taught through this before, but this is where you've got people I know them in town here, and I know they're around the world, and they're in seminaries. They say the book of Daniel was not written in 539, because chapter 11 is so... These are the critics, the skeptics, those who doubt the Bible. Chapter 11 is so clearly a play-by-play of the Maccabean revolt from chapter 11, verse 1, up until verse 35, that there's no way in 539 Daniel could tell you every move of the Seleucid and Ptolemy kingdom of what they're doing and what their strategies were and how they were playing it. So this book of Daniel was not written in 539, the critics say. It was written in the 100s, like sometime during the Maccabean Revolt or shortly thereafter, to encourage the Jews. It was false media. It was a true history, but they are projecting it back, pseudo-writing it back to Daniel. So they'd read, oh, this is supposed to happen just like this. Everything's going to be okay. And so they say you can't read the book of Daniel as if it was written by Daniel. The problem with that is archaeology and inscriptions that have been found that only Daniel could go know. For example, they also say the writer did not know anything about the last king of Babylon because it says it was Belshazzar, and it was actually Nebuchadnezzar's father. I'll think of it here in a minute. But the actual king of Babylon had moved south and left his son Belshazzar in charge of it, and no one knew this except the book of Daniel says it. No one knew this in history, and they mocked the book of Daniel in the 1800s, for example, when the critics were coming out strong, because it gave you history that it wasn't even true. There's not recorded anywhere else until they dug up the cylinder that says, I left my son Belshazzar in charge of Babylon, and I moved south, and his name appears 3 times on different cylinders of the Babylonians. And so all of a sudden you realize why no one else recorded it, because the Persians came in and took the city and took over Babylon, and everybody forgot it. No one recorded it. Only those documents that were in existence at the time, written by the king, existed. And other eyewitnesses, which was only one, was Daniel, who was in the palace reading them writing on the wall, was recording it, which then says this could only be written in 539, which makes this total prophecy, and you don't need to make any kind of guess about it. Did you understand what I just said? Meaning it confirms that this book was written by someone that had to see it, and that confirms this. But nonetheless, chapter 11, verses 1, going all the way up to 35, is dealing with the fall of the Greek Empire, or the death of Alexander, him dividing it up into his four generals, and then they end up fighting the Seleucids and the Ptolemies fight, and it goes 165, 168 BC. We got all kind of, I could teach you the whole thing. But verse 36 is interesting. Well, let's go back to verse 33. I'm going to go back to verse 31. This is the end of Antiochus Epiphanes. His armed forces will rise up to desecrate the temple fortress. That's the abomination that causes desolation referred to by the preterist. That did take place. And will abolish the daily sacrifice. That's what Antiochus Epiphanes did, that a Seleucid king. And they will set up the abomination that causes desolation. It was a statue of Zeus with Antiochus's face on it. With flattery, he will corrupt those who have violated the covenant. In other words, if you walk away from the law of Moses, I'll flatter you, give you things, make you a friend of the king. That was an official title, a friend of the king. You got to wear a special hat. Said, you know, make the Seleucids great again. No, I just said that to be funny. I've got a mega hat. I'm proud of it. I'm going to put it on Facebook a little bit closer to the elections. But I've got one. But I'm just being funny. But the people who know their God will firmly resist him. Now, that's Antiochus Epiphanes, 168, 165, that whole period. Those who are wise will instruct many, though for a time they will fall by the sword or be burned or captured or plundered. So that's already taken place. That's not talking about you, but it is a pattern. Those who are wise in those days who are going to forsake and not follow him, they're going to instruct others and they're going to instruct many, but they'll be killed by the sword, they'll be burned in fire, they'll be captured and sold into slavery or plundered. When they fall, they'll receive a little help. Some people think that's a reference to the Maccabees rising up, Judas Maccabees and his brother rising up and causing the Maccabean revolt. And many who are not sincere will join them. That led into the Hasmonean kingdom, and it became a power base like any religious system, and it was corrupt. Some of the wise will stumble, so they may be refined, purified, and made spotless. In the Hebrew, that means refined means to be fused or cast. You're going to be walking, and then you're going to stumble and get confused. And what's happening is you're being fused or set into a cast. Purified means examined and made pure. And then spotless means they're cleansed. In other words, their stumbling puts them into a process of being purified and cast into a perfect image. Until the time of the end, for it will still come at the appointed time. Now that ends the Antiochus Epiphanes account, or the Seleucid account, but here goes verse 36. The king will do as he pleases. What king? He will exalt and magnify himself above every god and will say unheard of things against the God of gods. This is now the Antichrist in the future, because this process is going to continue. He will be successful until the time of wrath, there's a key word, time of wrath, is completed, for what has been determined must take place. He will show no regard for the gods of his fathers, and what does that mean? Or for the one desired by women. Now when it says will show no regard for the gods of his fathers, that some would say that it's plural gods, that would mean idols or the traditional gods of his culture. Or for the one desired by women. And the one desired by women, many understand that as being the seed of the woman, the Messiah. So he has no concern for that. Nor will he regard any god, but will exalt himself above them all. Now I'll tell you one strike against my concept that the Antichrist is going to be Muslim is because he ends up saying he is God. And it's kind of hard to see a Muslim saying that he is Allah in the flesh or that he is Allah. You understand? So that's a huge, it's like that's still a hurdle I'm looking at the end of my race. It's like, how are you going to get over that? I don't know yet. I'll keep twisting scripture until it fits. Nor will he regard any god, but will exalt himself above them all. Instead of them, he will honor a god of fortress, that means war, a god unknown to his fathers. See, now that would match That would match the rise of Islam, because this is a new god, although it built on some traditions. We can study that. He'll honor a god of a fortress, a god unknown to his fathers. He will honor with gold and silver, with precious stones and costly gifts, whatever that would refer to. He will attack the mightiest fortresses with the help of a foreign god and will greatly honor those who acknowledge him. He's going to do the same thing. He's going to flatter those who wear his hat. He will make them rulers over many people and will, here's a key word, distribute the land at a price. When it says distribute the land, it can only refer, well, it can refer to anything, but in the biblical concept, when you start distributing the land, you're talking about dividing the promised land and taking it from the Jews and giving it to others. Whoever honor you, give you treasures, help support you, I'll give you this. I'll divide this land, which would probably take place at the halfway point. He's made it, gives them the land, the Temple Mount, everything at the halfway, or for a seven-year treaty. At the halfway, he breaks it. And if you'll support him in his military efforts, he'll divide the land. And that's where the Jews, in fact, they're supposed to flee because their land is being distributed. At the time of the end, the king, now here it is, if this is the Antichrist, which I think it is, again, he's ruling the world apparently, but watch this. At the time of the end, the king of the south will engage him in battle. And the king of the north will storm out against him with chariots and cavalry and a great fleet of ships. He will invade many countries and sweep through them like a flood. He'll also invade the beautiful land, that's Israel. Many countries will fall, and watch this, especially in the news today. Many countries will fall to him, although he's having trouble with the king of the north, the king of the south. And Revelations talks about the king marching across the Euphrates from the east. Many countries will fall, but Edom, Moab, and the leaders of Ammon will be delivered from his hand, meaning he will not be able to access Jordan or Saudi Arabia, which would include Bahrain and United Emirates. Just saying. I mean, I'm just saying that those are the little, that's the beginning. That, what's that mean? It means we watch. But that Bahrain is right off of Jordan. United, it's right there. It's the little pieces coming together. And they're talking about Saudi Arabia joining this Abraham covenant thing. What's it called, Abraham? Activate Abraham covenant, whatever it is. But that's what it's called, right? Did you know what it's called? I read it, but I didn't remember it. It's called Abraham. The Abraham allegiance or something. Okay. At that time, the king of the south will engage him in battle, and the king of the north will storm out against him with chariots and cavalry and a great fleet of ships. He'll invade many countries and sweep through them like a flood. He will also invade Israel, the beautiful land. Many countries will fall, but Edom, Moab, and the leaders of Ammon will be delivered from his hand. He will extend his power over many countries. Egypt will not escape. He will gain control of the treasures of gold and silver, all the riches of Egypt with the Libyans, the Nubians, in submission. That would be Put and Cush. That's North Africa. But reports, here it is, but reports from the east and the north will alarm him. Meaning, you're having trouble from the king of the north and there's an army coming from the east will alarm him. We're talking possibly about Armageddon being set up here. And he will set out in a great rage to destroy and annihilate many, possibly the Jews. He will pitch his royal tents between the seas, that's the Mediterranean Sea and the Dead Sea on Jerusalem, the beautiful holy mountain, Mount Moriah, the Temple Mount that he'd given to the Jews. He's going to take that. Yet he will come to his end and no one will help him. Okay, there's that right there taking place. Again, a lot of things in there. I'm trying to get a parallel for these things. Go to Matthew chapter 24, verse 3. Matthew 24, verse 3. Now, those mountains, they do say that they're, well, let's go to Matthew 24. Now, this is now 30 A.D. So, obviously, 168 is already, in the Maccabean B.C. has already taken place. That's the end. The Greeks are ending right here. Rome is now in power. Jesus has been born. He's grown up. Now, it's 30 A.D., Rome is going to destroy the temple in 70 A.D., ending the temple worship at that time. So again, there is a huge overlap here between 30 A.D. of the resurrection of Christ and the fall of Jerusalem. You've got a 40-year overlap of the church and Israel actively worshiping on the Temple Mount. So forget that teaching. You can't have Israel on the Temple Mount while the church is functioning on the earth. Why? Well, because you can't. Well, they did it for 40 years. Even the Christians would go up on the Temple Mount while the sacrifice, even Paul went up and participated in worship on the Temple Mount in the Jewish temple. It's recorded in Acts. So you've got the church meeting on the Temple Mount while sacrifices are taking place on the Temple Mount. You can't have the church in Israel at the same time. That's a fantasy. That's a theory, except I just disproved the theory. It's a fair. It's like, well, you see, you've got to have the church raptured before Israel can have the last 70th week. It's like, oh, sure. Why? Because the temple didn't burn out. The temple curtain was torn when Jesus died, but it didn't burn down. So you've clearly got 40. Okay, that's enough of that. Do you understand what I'm saying? It's like, that's a weak argument. Nonetheless, Jesus is talking here in 30 AD. So all this Maccabean stuff, Antiochus Epiphanes, the abomination of the cause of desolation, has already taken place. So the preterists say, it's already done. Jesus is still going to be talking about it, saying, look for it. It's coming. It's like, wait, Jesus, don't you understand history? It already happened. Here we go, chapter 24. Chapter 24, verse 1. Jesus left the temple. Last time he leaves the temple. And was walking away when his disciples came to him to call his attention to its buildings. Do you see all these things? And of course, it was glorious. He asked. He says, do you see all these things? I tell you the truth, Jesus says, not one stone here will be left on another. Every one will be thrown down. Now, again, we do have the issue today that when you go to Jerusalem, you see the western wall. You can see, you see the whole retaining wall holding up Mount Moriah where it was filled in so they could have the Temple Mount. But the surface of the Temple Mount is all gone. You've got retaining walls, you've got stairs coming up to it, but the temple's all gone. So some people say, well, there's still part of the temple left. There's part of the Temple Mount. The temple, it's all gone. But there is a retaining wall. It's like, you know, the landscape of your yard. Your house is gone, but you still got the timbers holding up the dirt or something. And that's what it is. So keep that in mind. People try to find a new place for the temple, and maybe that they're right, but archaeology makes it pretty solid. It's on the Temple Mount today, or that's where it was. As Jesus was sitting down, that he says, all these things will be torn down. He says, all this will be torn down. Not one stone will be left upon another. And the disciples wisely don't bring it up. Say, oh, well, tell us more. Because like, NSA's listening. You know, it's like they're not. They go off onto Mount Moriah or Mount Olives across the Kidron Valley. As Jesus was sitting on Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately and says, tell us, they said, when will this happen? What will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age? So they asked three questions. Now, I'll just tell you a little personal story. When I was in Jerusalem for the first time in 2007, I wanted to do this. I wanted to go to Mount Moriah. I wanted to walk across Jerusalem through the Kidron Valley up to Mount of Olives and sit there and read chapter 24 of Matthew on the Mount of Olives as I looked at the Temple Mount. I thought that would be really, really cool. So I did it, and it was like reading while you sat and grind. Nothing. It was like nothing. And then I went back, and Tony says, we got an email. Four boys had just emailed us. Four or five of the boys had emailed us, and all the headings was, don't worry, everything's fine. And then another one, don't worry, everything's fine. And it's like, what? What is it? And so we tried the time difference stuff. We finally got a hold of them. Hawkeye had been out, Nathan, our fourth son, had been out in a cross-country retreat in the mountains where they were doing some running in the mountains. They had a break, so they were riding some bikes and coming doing some mountain bike riding. They jumped with the bike coming down the mountain, and the front wheel came off, oh, like this, and the wheel landed on the fork, stuck in the ground, and he landed on his face, tore up his face, pulled his lip off. He had to put plastic surgery on here, had to put bars in his jaw, and we're in Israel. Reading on the Mount of Olives, the scriptures, being holy and having this experience with God. And what I get is, don't worry, everything's fine. The Hawkeye's face is planted out there on the mountain somewhere. He's fine. I mean, his whole lip had it again. But that's when this used to be a real special, you know, and it still is. But now whenever I read this, because I always thought it'd be fun to read this on the Mount of Olives and just reflect and look over and what does it mean. And now that all comes in whenever I read that, that always rushes. And if I ever read this again to you, I'll probably tell you the same story. Nonetheless, they asked three questions. When will this happen? The temple stones be torn down. Now, this is going to happen in 70 A.D. Now, watch these questions. You know this. I don't want to bore you. You know these things. Tell us, they said, when will this happen? When will the temple be torn down? The answer is, historically, 70 AD. There won't be one stone left upon another in 71 AD. What will be the sign of your coming? Well, that's another question. The stones are torn down in 70 AD. What will it be like with your coming, your parousia, your appearance? And of the end of the age. Now, the end of the age is confusing, or you've got to be careful with the end of the age. So we've asked two questions. When will the temple be torn down? 70 AD. What is the sign of your coming? That's yet future. Now, the end of the age, what do you mean? Because even in the New Testament, it talks about the age has ended. What ended? The Old Testament age ended with the death of the Christ and the resurrection, and we no longer need temple sacrifices. We are now in a new age. We're in the New Testament, or what Testament means, covenant. We've begun the new age. The new, you understand the difference? Old Testament, New Testament. When Jesus died, it ended the age. So that's a tricky question. It's almost like, what do you mean, end of the age? Do you mean the end of time before you set up the kingdom? Or do you mean what ends the Old Testament age and Israel's set aside? And so we've actually, in a sense, got three questions. One answer is 70. When will this happen? 70 AD. What will be the sign of your coming? Well, just like before. These are the things that are going to take place before I return. And what will be the sign of the end of the age? Well, my resurrection. Or the death on the cross. Or does age, end of the age, mean the end of time before the kingdom? You understand what I'm saying? So here he goes. He answers it. And now what we're trying to do here is find parallels. I'm trying to put, all like you saw those verses, Daniel, Matthew, Luke, Paul, and 1 Thessalonians, and of course, then you got Revelation, some verses, all these things in parallel form. And he says this, watch out that no one deceives you. That is a theme in Paul's teaching and Jesus' teaching about end times. First of all, before we begin, be careful that you don't get deceived. And that's, now I'm teaching. And what I should say to you is I'm going to explain some things. Be careful that I don't deceive you. For many will come in my name claiming I am the Christ. Okay, there's false messiahs. And will deceive many. Meaning many will be, do not be deceived, but many are going to be deceived. You will hear of wars and rumors of wars. Okay, but see to it that you are not alarmed. Such things must happen, but the end will still come. Now that's the answer to the end. You're going to hear of wars and rumors of wars, but it's nothing. In other words, that's history. There's a war. There's a rumor of war. There's a cold war. There's these things happening in between nations. Yeah, that's called history. So every time a war breaks out in the Middle East, it's like, this could be it. Jesus, don't be alarmed. These things must happen. I mean, we're going to play out history. Every war is not the end of the age. It's the sign that we're in an age. You will hear of wars and rumors of war, but see to it that you are not alarmed. Such things must happen, but the end is still to come. Now, in other words, when you hear of a war, that's not the end. Nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom, because that's the way it is. I mean, so far he's not telling you anything except this is the way it's going to be. I mean, he's going to go to the cross, he's going to be resurrected, and then history's going to continue. What's it going to be like? Well, there's going to be wars, rumors of wars, nations will rise, kingdoms will fall. What's this mean? It means we're still living in time. There will be famines and earthquakes in various places. All these are the beginning of birth pains. Now, you can say they're going to intensify, but understand there's been wars and rumors of wars, earthquakes in various places since 30 AD. And what did it mean? It didn't mean birth pains. We're going to give birth here in the next couple hours. It means there's a whole age coming here where you're going to just be in birth pains of this thing just trying to come. Waves of it coming and going. Nothing's going to happen. This means nothing. Then you'll be handed over to be persecuted and put to death. And you'll be hated by all nations because of me. At that time, many will turn away from the faith and will betray and hate each other. And many false prophets will appear and deceive many people. Now that verse 9 switches. It says, then. Now they're going to be handed over and persecuted. Now they'll be handed over in 70 AD. And they're going to go to all the nations. And they've been dispersed in all the nations since 70 AD. Okay? And we think about it in the 1900s. But they've been dispersed. They've been around. They've been involved in the Crusades. They've been involved in the great Holy Roman Empire. They've been involved in everything, the Jews. And he's talking, well, now listen. Then you will be handed over and persecuted and put to death, and you'll be hated by all nations because of me. Now, that also has to be identified. You. Is that Jews or is that believers? Because he's talking to Jews, but they're believers. They're, in a sense, saved, or the process of salvation is going to take place. And so he says, you, that could refer to believers, will be handed over to be persecuted and put to death. So if it's Jews, that began in 70 AD. But if it's Christians, believers, that could be a sign of when, before his coming, the return is coming, is where. And so now this could become that great falling away. In fact, you can read it both ways. Is this, read it the Jews, or then go back and read it, he's talking about Christians. If it's the Jews, it began in 70 AD and is continuing up until the end. Or if it's Christians, meaning the history is going to happen this way, but there's a time coming when all the nations will unite against Christians and put you to death and persecute you and hate you because of me. Now that's crucial because that helps identify who you is. The Jews potentially were not persecuted in 70 AD because of Jesus. They were persecuted because, you know why they were persecuted by the Romans? Because they went to war against the Romans. You understand? It's like, why did the Romans do that? Because that's how they tried everything to appease the Jews, to help the Jews. The last thing the Jews, what Romans want is another costly war. You know, you've been in a country like that. The last thing we want is a war. Is there something we need to find? It's like, we can't put up with this. And let's just eliminate them. And they didn't go persecute the Jews because they were Jews. They went over there and fought the Jews because they were in revolt against the Roman Empire. I mean, it's not like, you know, a spiritual battle. It's like common sense. It's kingdom rising against kingdom. This now is different because all nations because of me. So there's going to become Christian persecution because of me, which is interesting because have we now entered into that last 70, the 70th week right here? Are we in this 70th week right now? Now, if you're pre-trib, you're going to be taken out and not face this. And this persecution is going to have to happen to, you know, the new believers that just get born again all of a sudden. The Jews are not going to be persecuted during the first 3.5 years. What are the Jews doing during the first 3.5 years? Celebrating because they've found who? They found the Christ. He gave them the temple. They're offering sacrifice. This is exclamation points. These are the Jews. The first 3.5 years, the first times and half a time, the Jews are not being persecuted. They could care less what's happening to the church because they're offering sacrifices. They've got a 7-year treaty. Meanwhile, those who are naming Christ are being persecuted. They are being killed. They're being hated by all the nations. The nations are in agreement. Give Israel back the Temple Mount, the Antichrist at least is. Meanwhile, the Antichrist and all the nations are hating on those who name Christ. There may be a distinction right there. So Jesus may have now just entered into the 70th week. What is it like at your coming? First, when will these things happen? Well, first of all these things, you're going to have wars and all this is going to take place. Then he's going to talk about the signs of his coming, potentially. Verse 12. Okay, I'll read it again. Verse 9. Then you will be handed, you, Jews or Christians, will be handed over to be persecuted and put to death, and God is the one handing you over, and you'll be hated by all nations because of me, either Jews or Christians. At that time, many will turn away from the faith. Turn away from the faith. That sounds Christian. That doesn't sound Jewish. They're not turning away from the law. They're turning away from the faith and will betray and hate each other. And many false prophets will appear and deceive many people. So when that persecution happens, what's going to happen to the church? Many are going to turn away from the faith. It's like, we never really believe that. It's already happening. It's been happening for 1,000 years of people turning away from the faith because of just, you know, persecution or just convenience or compromise. But they're turning away now. And then in that will happen. They'll be betraying each other. They're going to hate each other. Many false prophets will appear and deceive many people. Because of the increase of wickedness, the love of most will grow cold. Love of most will grow cold. Some interpret that's how you treat people, like a Hamas generation, a generation of violence. Some understand that the love of most will grow cold. The love of what? The love of you're being persecuted because of who? He says, because of me. And your love will grow cold. Your love for me will grow cold. So again, is that just social love? Everybody's the Hamas generation? It could be. Or because they're killing everybody because of me, your love for me grows cold. And so that, you know, that's a nice way of seeing that, because now you're into the church. And it goes, so watch this. But he, okay, love of most will grow cold. But watch this. But some are going to endure. But he who stands firm to the end will be saved. Again, let me line this up. He who stands firm to the end, meaning during this time of hate, this time of persecution, and you're being persecuted because of me, most people are going to grow cold towards Christ. But you who stand firm to the end, you who continue to confess my name, even to death, you will be saved. Now, right away, the average Sunday school believer saved. It's like, oh, so if we make it here, we get to be saved. Wait, no, you're already saved. You're already in the body. You're not going to get saved. You're already saved. But, you know, if you turn away, you lost your salvation. Well, then you were never saved. You know, so you don't get saved by enduring persecution. You understand? That's a work. You don't get saved by getting baptized. You don't get saved by taking communion. You don't get saved by enduring persecution. You get saved by faith in Christ. You get saved by trusting in the Messiah. And so you're already saved. Let me throw this in there, because it lines up with what I'm teaching, what I believe. I might be wrong. If you'll endure this 3.5 years, Daniel says times, times, and half a time, you're enduring this right here. If you'll endure this and still love me, confess my name, you'll be saved. How? Saved is another form of, it's the three phases of salvation. It's going to be justification, sanctification, and glorification. Justification is when you confess Christ as Lord, you're justified before God because your sins have been taken care of. Your life, you're now being sanctified in life. You're now developing. You're becoming holy. You're learning to follow Christ, but you're not totally saved because you still have a sin nature. But at the end, you will be saved. That's why it says you're saved, you're being saved, and you're going to be saved. That's all Greek terms in the New Testament, and all of them are true because you are saved. But right now in this whole process, you're being saved, you're experiencing salvation, you're becoming more saved, renewing your mind. But then in the end, you're going to be glorified and you're going to be resurrected and you will be saved. So those who endure to the end, you're not going to be saved justified, because the very fact you're here is you're justified. You're in Christ. The very fact you're going through persecution is you're being sanctified. But when you get right here, you make it to the end of the times, times, and half a times, boom, you're saved, rapture. Again, you can reject that if you want to. But that for me is screaming, rapture, rapture, rapture. It says, but he who stands firm to the end will be saved. You're going to be saved out of this persecution. Verse 14, and why is this taking place? Why would you let that happen to the believers? Be persecuted because of this right here. Because you have one job. Your job is to proclaim the good news to all the nations. And verse 14, and this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all nations. Well, what are the nations doing at this time? They're persecuting you. So as they're cutting your head off, taking away your possessions, persecuting you, what are you doing? You're either compromising or you're testifying that I'm waiting for Jesus Christ. And if you want to play the timeline game, if they sign a treaty right here, the Jews start building the temple right here, you know you've got 7 years of the 70th week. And you know, counting months, you've got times, times, and a half. You've got 3.5 years before this shows up here. And I say, well, no one knows the day or the hour. Right, you're not going to know the day or the hour, but understand, you're within times, time, and half a time. You're being persecuted. They're offering sacrifice. The Jews are very happy because they've met their Messiah, and you're being killed and persecuted by all the nations. And now you've got to decide, do you really believe this? Well, if you go to the average church that's just teaching social gospel, love each other, you're like bailing out. This is not what I signed up for. But if you're understanding the text of Scripture, that this has been the plan from Genesis all the way through Isaiah, through Revelation, Jesus told about it, you say, I know exactly where I'm at. I'm going to continue to testify. Cut my head off if you want to. But Jesus Christ is coming back, and I can tell you, we're within days of this. It's a little different. It's like, well, no one knows the day or hour. Go ahead, stick your head under a rock, And Paul says, you're not in darkness like those who live in the world. They're in darkness. Yeah, some people that are believers in the typical church that doesn't know anything, they're in darkness. How dark? They're bailing out and joining the Antichrist. But you are in the light, and you know your salvation is drawing near. Lift up your heads, he's going to say in Luke. Lift up your heads, your salvation draws near. Going on, verse 15. So, when you see standing in the holy place, Mount Moriah, the Temple Mount, the Holy of Holies, the abomination that causes desolation, spoken of through the prophet Daniel, let the reader understand, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. So right here, those who are believers who are being persecuted, if you endure to the end, you're going to be taken up or saved, whatever that means. Now, when you see the abomination at the halfway point, the Antichrist is going to break the treaty. He's going to go into the Temple Mount. He's going to set himself up in the Temple Mount. When you see that, now when we see that, we may be out of there already. But when the Jews see that, the Jews are going to be like, oh, wait a minute. We're having a party here. We're celebrating some kind of a holy day. It's like the Antichrist says, no, I'm taking over. And then when that happens, now he's talking to the Jews. He's talking to those who are in Judea. See this right here? It says, so when you see standing in the holy place the abomination that causes desolation, whatever that is, at one point, with Seleucid in 168, Antiochus Epiphanes, the Seleucid Empire, it was an offering of a pig on the altar with pig's blood burning the offering, and a statue of Zeus with Antiochus's face on it. That was the abomination of 168 B.C. When you see the abomination spoken through the prophet Daniel, which means that wasn't the abomination spoken by Daniel because it's still to come. It was an attempt to be, but it wasn't fulfilled yet. Let the reader understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Now, what mountains? The mountains are Edom, Moab, and Ammon. Flee to, basically, it's Petra, but it's going to be Saudi Arabia. Let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let no one on the roof of his house go down to take anything out. Notice, the church, the believers are saved, and the Jews flee. Now we can tie Zechariah into this, because Zechariah is going to say, when the Jews see the one they pierced, they recognize when the sign of the Son of Man appears, they realize, oh my gosh, that's Jesus. That's our Messiah. It's not this guy, it's that guy. We got the wrong guy. Now, the church is already gone, so they go into fleeing because God's going to now reestablish Israel. They've got now 3.5 years, and now you've got the church is raptured out of the earth, and you've got God sealing the 144,000 Jews who are said to flee to Edom, Moab, or Ammon, flee to the mountains. We're going to see that several times. It's going to be detailed in the book of Revelation that they're out in the wilderness, and that's where they're going to be until Jesus comes down to the earth during that time period right there. We're going to quit. We're going to pick this up next week in Matthew 24. Now, what's interesting is Luke in 21 records the same thing. And Luke is going to give you the same teaching, but it's going to be just, it's like two people listening to the teacher taking notes. Luke's got notes on, it's the same thing. It's just going to give you a different perspective. And like I said last week, I think that is when Paul starts talking in 2 Thessalonians and he says, you already know these things. There's a good chance he's talking about Matthew 24 and Luke 21, and then he goes off and starts telling you stuff based on information that, well, where's your notes, Paul? He says, well, you already know all this, so I'm just going to review it. It's like, can we hear the introduction series? Well, we may be looking at the introduction series. So it is possible, and you should at least try it, reading 1 and 2 Thessalonians eschatological verses with in mind, Paul is just detailing Matthew 24 and Luke 21. You don't have to accept that, but you have to try that. Is he just detailing what you already understand from Matthew 24, which was already taught in Daniel? Okay, I'll pray, and we'll pick this up next week. Father, we do thank you for your truth. We thank you for the opportunity to hear these things. We do want the truth. We do not want our own opinions. We do not want to compromise the truth. But, Father, we do want to be ready. If there's deliverance coming before persecution, we embrace that. But, Father, if we're called to endure persecution and suffering, we ask that we would be faithful to you and be able to testify to your truth, your coming kingdom, in the face of a world that is already passing away. We do thank you for these things in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, thank you for coming. Are there any questions? Okay, well, good. That's good. No, go ahead. If anybody's got a thought or question, I'm going to shut this off.